This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, nor despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Remind me, what's this schedule? I always forget. You know, do meditation till 8, is that right?
7:30.
So what do you do until 7:30?
Yeah.
Little talk beforehand?
Yeah.
Introduction to meditation?
Meditation, yeah, roughly.
And then at 8 o'clock, what do we do?
Till 7:30, then meditate till 8, yeah. And then a bit of talk after.
Question and answer after. So Dhamma talk before and question and answer afterwards. Okay. So what should I do a Dhamma talk about? I had an idea, but I want to see if you've got a better one.
Unless there's a question in the box.
Okay, so...
How about anger? Anger management.
No, that's a terrible question.
That's a bad question.
Yeah.
No, I'm just thinking about that because I've been talking about people get, all these people getting around all eye stuff, you know, all angry and violent.
Right.
Terrible stuff. I mean, not like the old days. Remember people used to just get drunk and stuff. I mean, that was bad enough. But now they're supercharged.
Okay, yeah.
Am I on the right track? Or would you rather talk about birds and the bees?
I would actually.
Don't do that now.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about the birds and the bees. Right. So I'm going to talk about the birds and the bees, but from a Buddhist perspective. Alright? Sorry? Sorry?
Did you really
any
she said angry bird.
Yeah. Oh, she's a rooster all puffed up, he's pretty angry.
Alright. So, well, not quite about the birds and the bees and so on, but when I was coming in here, I was thinking, because when we used to come and give talks here, Rachel would always say, I'll give a talk about something really simple so that everyone can understand it. So I don't know whether it's because you guys are particularly simple or anything.
Especially simple.
So, but I always like a challenge. So when I was thinking about that, I thought, why don't I give a talk on the most complicated topic that I can think of? Just because otherwise I get bored if I do the same thing. So I'm going to give a talk 20 minutes on dependent origination.
Yes.
All right. Okay. Now, does anybody know what dependent origination is?
No.
No. Good, good. Then you don't have to unlearn everything. Okay?
You can read 20 things and still don't know what you read. I find it so complicated to read. I'm going to read this. I'm going to listen to your podcast. And that's still going to sink in. So you might be right in the first assessment.
Maybe, yeah, we'll see.
Dependent origination for beginners.
Yeah. So dependent origination is one of the core Buddhist teachings and something which is very central to the Buddhist philosophy. And it is about, well, it's about the birds and the bees, really. It's about where things come from, right? So that's the gist of it. And the idea that the Buddha was talking about 2,500 years ago, it's a very modern idea, because the Buddha was thinking and talking in terms of systems and processes, right? So where do we come from? Where does this life come from? How are we here, right? Where are we going? Right? How does this thing come? What is all this stuff? Right? So these fundamental processes, of course, typically in religions we find that these are answered by some kind of creation story. Right? So you say, where do we come from? Why are we here? What is this world here? Well, God did it. Right? And there'll be some creation process. And now, one of the interesting things in the Indian tradition, because India has always been a fascinating place from religion and philosophy in so many different ways, okay? And if you know anything about India and Indian culture, you'll know that, well, simplicity is not one of their virtues necessarily, right? There's a kind of whole multiplicity of different ideas and different philosophies and so on. But one of the ideas that they had in the Indian tradition before the Buddha, right? So this is not a Buddhist theory, but one before the Buddha, it gave a creation myth. This is in a book called the Rig Veda, which was maybe 500 years before the Buddha. And it said, talked about creation, and it said, but, and then it finished off by saying, but what was before all of this? All of this thing that we call creation, what lay before that? Yeah? Only he knows. Only he who sits in the highest heaven and looks down upon all creation from above, only he knows the answer to that. Or perhaps even he does not know. Yeah? Perhaps even he does not know. Yeah. So this is an amazing thing to find in a religious text. Yeah? Again, this is a 3,000-year-old religious text. Right? This kind of acknowledgement of the limits of knowledge. Yeah? So rather than telling a story about all the things that we can know, everything, we can know our ultimate origins, yeah? There's this idea that perhaps it's not even knowable to talk about origins in the sense of some ultimate beginning. And so rather than thinking of origins in terms of some ultimate beginning, the Buddha looked at it in terms of a process. We can't necessarily know where we came from in an ultimate sense, but we can understand what is going on here and now. And when we understand what's going on here and now, we can then infer from that to the past and the future. Okay? And this, of course, is very much what scientists do today. Right? So you understand, for example, you look at the ecosystem and the environment, and you can see the relationships between the weather and the different species and how these all fit together. And then you can look into the past and the geological record, and you can make inferences about what was happening in the past. And you can look at trends and tendencies and you can make inferences about the future. So you can't know everything about the past and the future, but you can know a lot of important things about it. So the Buddha's teachings on dependent origination were very much like that. So it's how do we, if we want to understand our past and the future, we begin by looking at our present and we understanding who we are in the present and how all this works in the present. Okay? And you may have heard of the Buddha's teaching of not self. Okay? Who knows about the Buddha's teaching of not self? Some people? A few people? Okay? Okay. So what does not self mean?
Well, it's not about the I, is it? It's about, it's not I and me, it's the general sort of sense of it. Is that something like that?
Something like that. Something like that, yeah. So the idea of the Buddha's teaching on not-self, again, is a very kind of modern idea, because it's thinking in terms of processes and systems and relations, rather than entities. Right? So the idea of not-self, not-self doesn't mean that you don't exist, okay? What it means is that you don't exist in the way that you think you do. Okay? So obviously when we think about who I am, then who am I? I'm my thoughts. I am my feelings. I am my body. I am a citizen. We have all these ideas about what I am. And the Buddha simply said that it was actually a very simple observation that none of those things are permanent. Right? Try to identify with anything. What are you? That thing that you're identifying with is changing. Yeah? So the word I, when we're talking about a self, is actually just a label that we put on a process. And that the name of that process the Buddha talked about is dependent origination. Okay? So when the Buddha taught dependent origination, he taught it in many different ways, but the classical formulation of it is in terms of 12 steps or 12 stages of dependent origination. And I'm not going to talk about all those 12 stages in detail tonight. In fact, I'm not even going to talk about it even in brief. I'm only going to mention a couple of basic principles. Okay? One of the basic principles is that underlying dependent origination is that first thing is what is given, what is here, right? What is our reality? Okay? We're sitting here in this seat and we feel things. Yeah, just think in terms of physical feelings to start with. It's the easiest to start with. We have certain experiences. Some of those experiences come from our choices, right? If your shoes are pinching you, well, your shoes aren't pinching you because you weren't wearing shoes. I'll choose a different example. Some of them because of your personal choices. Some of them because of the weather. Right? Whatever, but you're feeling certain feelings, right? That's just how life is. It's just how the world of experience is given to you. Right? It's what's presented to you. That's number one. And the second thing is, how do you respond to that? Right? How do you respond to the world that you're in? Yeah? That's something that we can choose. Right? So when we're in a particular situation, maybe we might be provoked to act out of greed or out of hatred or whatever, but we have a degree of control about whether we're going to act out of those things. Yeah? The third aspect of dependent origination, which is very important, is that we then create the kind of world that we live in because of those choices. Yeah? Okay? So this is the way that these things work together is very complex. I'll just give you one example, and this is just from my personal history and my family history. My grandfather came from Yorkshire, and he was brought up in a very poor family, like very, very dirt poor family there. And as a young kid, you know, only 10 or 11 years old, he had a job working on the docks or in the factories, I can't remember what, but he was laying cables. So his job was to crawl inside a big drum and to crawl around the drum all day laying cable. That was his job. So as you can expect, he thought, I've got to get out of here. And he worked hard and saved up some money, and eventually saved up enough money to be able to emigrate to Canada. Right? Start a new life. Yeah? In the beautiful, far off country of Canada. Unfortunately, there were no tickets on the ship to Canada. So he said, where else can I get a ticket to? They said, there's this place called Perth. He said, that'll do. So he got a ticket to Perth, and then when he came to Perth, right, young kid from Yorkshire, gets off the boat. What does he do? First thing he does is he sees people sunbathing on Fremantle Beach. Wow, he said, this is the life for me. That night, he's in Fremantle Hospital. Which is funny, right? Except he later got skin cancer and died of cancer. Right? So it's not so much funny anymore, is it? Still a bit funny. He had a good life in between. Yeah. So, but this is the story that I tell, because it's a story to me that when that kind of illustrates that kind of intertwining of these different things. You know, part of what the situation that he was in was just where he was at. He just happened to be born in Yorkshire, and this was the situation he was in, right? Then how did he respond to that, right? He wanted something, right? He wanted to make a new life. And so even though he had very limited choices at that time, right, he still responded constructively to that and put in the causes for creating a new life for himself, yeah? But even so, even though he put in those causes, he didn't have full control over that, right? It depended on the external conditions as well, right? So this is important to remember. So Buddhism does not teach that you can just create any kind of world you want because of, you know, your karma or because of what you do, right? The world has a certain inertia to it, has a certain stiffness to it. You can't just make the world be what you want, right? So he had to work with those worldly conditions, and then he ended up creating a new life for himself, yeah, and came to Australia. And then that was, Australia is not like, it's not perfect, but it gave him the opportunity to live in a way that he could never have done if he'd been there before. Now, so the teaching on dependent origination is really of taking these kinds of things and it's applying it to this idea of what we call rebirth in Buddhism, okay? So who can tell me what rebirth is? Or reincarnation?
When you're assigned a path and then you are reborn into another entity.
Yep. Okay. So you're
bringing that wisdom from your previous life.
Okay, yep. So it's when you die and you get reborn in another place, another entity, another life. So rebirth is one of the teachings of Buddhism. I know not everyone believes in rebirth, so that's all right. It's not like we don't have like thought police or anything like that. So if you don't believe in it or you're skeptical about it, that's fine, okay? But just, you know, it's useful to just try to understand how the Buddha was approaching this thing. So one of the things when thinking about the idea of rebirth is that when people think about that, they usually think about like a soul or a self or something like that. So they think that there is a thing which is the same here that's the same in the next life. Right? Or if they remember their past life, then they think, oh, that they have something like a soul or something which is in their past life, which they have here. Yeah. And the Buddha said, no. The Buddha says you can understand that process of rebirth as a process, as a flowing on of conditions. He used the idea of like a vijnana sota, a stream of consciousness. That idea of stream of consciousness, a very powerful metaphor. Yeah. So it's like a stream which maybe flows from one village to the next, right? Is the stream in one village the same stream as in the next village? Well, kind of, right? But it's not identical, right? What is true is that if you dump pollution in the stream on one village, then the next village, they're going to get that pollution, right? It's cause and effect, right? So the process of conditionality is the process of cause and effect. So just as my grandfather was able to had one life, which was just where he was at, and through his own choices was able to create a new life for himself here in Australia. Right? So the process of dependent origination is similar to that, except it's talking about being reborn in that same way. Right? So it's saying because of the choices that we make, because of the kind of life that we live, because of how we choose to respond to the situation that we find ourselves in. Right? We can build for ourselves a new life, a new world, a new reality in the future. And in that new reality, are we identical with this person that we are here today? Not really. Are we? We're also not completely different. Right? But it's just like yesterday I was a bit of a different person than I am today. We're always changing. So this idea of not self is like it's neither completely the same nor it's completely different. So through the actions and choices you make today, you generate a new life in the future, which is conditioned by the choices that you make in this life. And in particular, you're going to suffer. That's it. So even though my grandfather came to Perth, and relative to where he grew up in Yorkshire, this is the promised land, right? And beautiful shiny beaches and all of those things, still he got sunburnt. Still it's not perfect. So no matter what kind of world we build, no matter how good the choices that we make are, we're still going to suffer in whatever realm that we end up in, whatever life we end up in. So from a Buddhist point of view, the whole idea of rebirth is deeply depressing. Okay? That's the whole point. So we try to find freedom. Okay? So the Buddha said, this is the situation that we're in, this is what our life is like, whatever choices we are, we're going to lead to some kind of situation where we will suffer. How are we to find freedom from this? And this is the purpose of the Buddha's path. How do we find freedom? And that's what we do, all this meditation and so on. Ultimately, this is the ultimate goal of Buddhism, to find that freedom that we call Nibbana. No more rebirth. So this is my very, very brief description for you about dependent origination, how rebirth happens without soul. How the Buddha explained things in terms of systems, its interrelation, natural processes. So we understand our own life, our consciousness, our mind, our being, we understand using the same kinds of ideas that we use for understanding nature. Understanding systems, understanding relations, understanding processes, understanding energies, understanding change. All the things we can observe in ourselves, that's all there is. That's what rebirth is a continuation of that same process. So in a minute we're going to do some meditation, but before we do the meditation, we can have some more questions after the meditation. But are there any quick questions that you'd like to ask before we do the meditation? Anything that you found completely confusing? Yeah, come on.
Would it be reasonable to sort of think along the lines that if you hear, like you say, keep changing, get older and more than that, eventually you die and then you're born again, it's just the same, just like you said about the strips, the flowing off.
Yeah.
What comes out next is whatever comes out next is part of the same thing, really. It's this change of state, if you like.
Yeah.
That's not too bad then, is it?
Yeah. Conditioning process. It's not too bad.
No, it's not all misery and depressing.
Well, no, it's not all misery and depressing, because there's good places and there's bad places, right? Yeah. So you can end up in many different realms.
But well, no, it's optional as well. If you're really, if you're poor, me, and hard done by, miserable, so a lot of that's your own doing anyway.
It depends, yes. But again, that's why I mentioned in that story, like, it's not just the choices that he made, but it's also the situation that you find yourself. So we through karma, like the karma in that particular case was that my grandfather made a choice. He said, "Oh, I'm going to go to Perth," right? So he didn't have to make that choice. He could have stayed where he was, or he could have waited till the next boat was going and gone to Canada or whatever, and then everything would have been different. So he did make a choice, but the fact that he'd come to Perth didn't determine everything that happened to him when he got here, right? That shaped the possibilities. Right? If he'd gone to Canada, he probably wouldn't have gone to hospital from sunburn, right? But he didn't have to do that, right? That was just his choice to go sunbathing. Huh? But it might have been something else, right? He might have got eaten by a grizzly bear instead. And so the point is that there's always unexpected dimensions to the choices that we make.
Is suffering linked to your level of consciousness?
Very good question. Is suffering linked to your level of consciousness? Yes, it is. Yeah.
So to escape suffering, you can reduce your level of consciousness?
Well, in a way, kind of. Yeah, because yes, that's what we do, right? If you're going for an operation or something like that, or if you have pain in back, you take painkillers. So that's what we do, is we try to manage it. But that's obviously not a long-term solution, right? Because it's that suffering at a fairly narrow level, but at the same time, having it more consciousness, right, feels better, right? Being more conscious is more pleasant, knowing more things, having more understanding, right? So this is something that's very subtle, but when you start to look at it, you realize how true it is. So for example, just to take a very simple case, if you're walking through the streets and you see a sign pointing to a certain place, and you're like, hang on, where does that go, or what's that place, right? There's confusion in your mind, yeah? And then when you realize the answer, oh no, it's that place that it's going to, and when that moment of clarity comes, right, it feels good, right? It feels satisfying, right? And so that knowing feels good. That's why you are all here tonight, right? Because you want to know, because knowing feels good. Yeah. So sometimes, yes, we do reduce sort of severe suffering by shutting down, but ultimately it's much healthier to work by expanding consciousness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't understand how we reduce suffering by shutting down.
Oh, I mean, just very simple things, like you take a painkiller to get rid of back pain.
Okay, sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Or, you know, it might be other things. It might be, you know, just I'm going to drink and get blotto because I can't face life.
ultimately that increases our suffering.
Well, that's right. It's a very short-term approach.
Yeah.
Might work once or twice.
In that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a coping strategy. Yeah.
In a nutshell, isn't this referring to the saying, you are what you are today because of what you were yesterday, and what you'll be tomorrow is dependent on what you are today?
Pretty much. Thank you. And that's a very good summary. Okay, so why don't we do some meditation, and if there's any more questions, we can talk about them afterwards. So, what kind of meditation would you like to do? Loving kindness? Breath meditation? No? Okay, so who wants to do loving kindness? Okay. Four elements. Four elements? Breath meditation? So we're looking pretty even so far. Yeah. There's something about not always getting what you want.
That's part of suffering.
Can you explain what the four elements one is, please?
Well, let's do that, because if people don't know what it is, at least we can learn what it is.
Yeah.
All right? That sounds good. I did the same thing when I was in Sri Lanka a little while ago. We had this group of youth group. They're all in there. They're all like students and stuff. And I said breath meditation, loving kindness meditation, and corpse meditation. And they were like, oh yeah, let's do the corpse meditation. So it was good. All right, we will do the four elements meditation. Everyone sitting quietly. take a minute to settle back into your seat. Becoming aware of the different feelings and sensations throughout your body. Notice the pressure on the seat when you're sitting there. The touch of cloth on your skin. Sometimes when your mind starts to wander off, thinking about this, thinking about that, just bring awareness to that. No, oh, okay. I'm just thinking now. And bring awareness back into your body. Your body is a very good friend in meditation. Grounds your awareness so beautifully in the present. Starting meditation on the four elements. And so these four elements in Buddhism are earth, water, fire and air. So we're going to spend a few minutes contemplating each in turn. We're going to look at these elements inside our own bodies and also outside in the world around. So we begin with the earth element. So the earth element refers to anything that has solidity and hardness. So focus inside your body on the most obvious things that have that quality of hardness. So for example, you can pay attention to the feeling of your teeth in your mouth. You can feel the hardness of them. From there, move your mind around through your body and just feel the hardness in the different parts of your body, especially in your spine, imagine if your spine wasn't there, if you took it out and put it beside you, then you'd have a, you'd flop down like a jellyfish. It's that element of hardness that keeps us upright on the seat. Get an idea, an impression in your mind of what this element of earth or of hardness is like inside your body, then also perceive the same element outside your body. Again, most obviously you'll feel that in the seat. The seat has a hardness, a resistance that keeps you upright. There's a solidity, and you can recognize that the same kind of thing, the same solidity and resistance in your seat is the same as the earth, the resistance, the hardness inside your own body. And of course the seat itself rests on the carpet. The carpet rests on the floor rests on the foundations, and the foundations rests on the whole earth. And this whole planet Earth is just there holding us up in our seat. Move to contemplate the water element. Again, we start with the most obvious kind of water element, and that's usually the saliva in your mouth. And you can feel that that saliva has a wetness to it, a stickiness, a slipperiness to it. It's quite a different quality than the quality of hardness. And without that quality of water in your body, your whole body would just dry up like dust and blow away. Again, move your mind scanning through the different parts of your body, and just contemplate the water, the wetness in all of the different parts of the body, and blood and tears and fluids in the organs, and the body is just filled with so many different kinds of liquids. explore the elements inside our body like this, part of what we're doing is feeling that element, and part of it is seeing it with the eye of our imagination. Both of those ways of knowing are perfectly good. And how you do that depends on you personally and what you find works in your meditation. So right now, we're just playing with just an initial trying out the meditation, so don't worry about it too much. If you can see it or feel it, if it's clear, if it's not clear, don't worry. Just try to see if you can get some kind of idea of that idea of wetness inside your body. Some idea of the wetness inside your body, pay attention to the same thing outside your body. And so that might be in the bodies of others, or it might be in the rain that's been falling outside, or the water in the pipes. And we can get some kind of feeling for that, the fact that we live in a world where that water element is there, and we know that if that was taken away, we couldn't survive. And all of those little bits of water, those little drops in the rain, or the little bits of moisture in the air, and then they connect through the rivers and the streams into the great oceans. If you've flown over the desert after it's rained, then it can be quite amazing, because you look down and you see the water flowing in the rivers and the streams across the desert, and it looks exactly like the arteries and the blood vessels in your own body. The blood in our veins is still chemically almost identical with the seawater that we came from. And so we have this connection between the water in our bodies and the water outside. to contemplate the heat element. So here again we start with what's ever the most obvious for me right now, then that's a slightly cool feeling of the air. And I can feel on my face. It's a little bit cool feeling of the air outside. So just pay attention to that feeling of coolness. Or maybe for you it's different. Maybe you might feel like a warmth. If you're wearing nice warm clothes, maybe inside there you can feel a warmth. Whatever's clear to you. And get a sense for what that's like, that temperature. And of course, this is a completely different kind of physical quality than solidity or liquidity. Temperature. This is what we call the fire element. So don't mistake it. When we talk about these elements, it doesn't mean literally fire, but fire just means heat. And it's either the presence or the absence of that heat element. Once you get an idea of that feeling of cold or cool or warm, then again move your mind through your body, scan through the different parts of the body and see if you can feel the temperature in those different parts. Sometimes there might be a striking temperature of warm or cool, other times there might be nothing in particular. Your body tends to be a fairly constant temperature, so you probably don't notice that very much. But that's also a kind of temperature. A neutral temperature is just another kind of temperature. It's just not so easy to notice. Our mind to extend outside our body to the world around and just have some perception or some reflection on the temperatures around. Outside it's a bit cold right now, so if you step just a few meters outside you feel a bit colder. Around us there are also some places where there's warmth, like say in the light bulbs in this building. It's quite hot. Underneath the ground, it's a bit cool, but it's also moderating, and if you go down a few meters, it's quite warm under the ground. And so as you cast your mind wider and wider over the world, you can see people's warm homes, hot car engines, burning fires, stoves, So the heat element has this characteristic of transformation. So you think about food, like if you want food to stay the same, you take heat out of it. You put it in the fridge or in the freezer. If you want food to be transformed, to be cooked, you put heat into it. You put it in the oven, put it on the stove. So all around the world we can see those same patterns of heat and cool, those flows of temperature and energy, just like we can see inside our own body. Come to the last of the four elements, the air element. The most obvious example of the air element is the breathing. We can feel that air coming into our lungs and going out. We know that, like all the other elements, without that element we couldn't live. Just a few minutes we have breath and we're gone. and we can feel the air element elsewhere in the body too. And our belly produces air, moves through the body, and we can feel it sometimes gurgling in our tummies. Sometimes coming out. Pay attention to the air element outside our bodies as well. And again, start with your breath. Your breath, you feel the air outside coming in, the air inside going out. It's just the same thing. What's in our lungs is the same thing as what's outside in the room. Actually, we've been in this room for a while now, so what we're breathing into our own lungs, part of that has also been in the lungs of everyone else in this room. And the air that we share is the air that nourishes all living things. And the air that blows across the face of the planet, stirring up the waters, rustling the leaves in the trees. The same air that we breathe is breathed by the lizards, by the snakes, breathed by the elephants in the jungles of Africa. It's breathed by people on the streets of New York. Breathed by birds in the sky. Even breathed by the fish, because they breathe the oxygen that's absorbed through the ocean. And so we're connected with all living beings, with this whole ball of life that we call planet Earth. Bring our awareness back, rest our awareness inside our heart, inside our body. In the meditation we've just shared, we've broken down the boundaries ourselves and the world outside. We've seen that what we consider to be ours, this body that we're so intimate with, is really is just a part of a much greater whole. And we're so attached to, so concerned about our own bodies. But what is inside our own bodies is just the four elements. Outside our bodies also is just the four elements. It's just the same. Why do we think of ourselves as being separate? Why do we think of ourselves as being somehow special? Meditating this, we have to break down those feelings of selfishness and we feel more like a part of a greater whole. We become less concerned with our own individual body, with this greater body, with this greater reality in which we live. now we're at the end of the meditation. So just take a minute to gradually open your eyes, come out of the meditation, and let your mind come back to normal. If you need to stand up and have a stretch or something, do so. So we've got a bit of time now, so if anybody has some questions that's arising out of the talk earlier or out of the meditation, then now's your time. You've probably forgotten everything about the talk already, right? No.
I don't know if this relates to the talk or not. But the thing that I was thinking about through the meditation and maybe through your talk as well is what is the self? And does the self exist only because we exist in a world where we interact with it? Or is there a deeper self? And so does it only come about through relating to?
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah, the self is something that exists only in a system of relations. Yeah, so it's not something that exists independently in and of itself. Yeah, and that's basically what the Buddha's teaching of not self is. It's about emphasizing the reality of interdependence, of connection, and realizing that we can't exist without this whole kind of system and this whole kind of thing that's going on around us. Yeah. So it's helpful to understand the Buddhist idea of not-self. It's helpful to understand like what were the kinds of ideas of self which people were believing in the time of the Buddha. Okay? Now, so first of all is that when we're using the word self in Buddhism, right, of course we're translating an Indian word, which is atta or atman, which doesn't quite mean the same thing as self does in English. Right? It's not too bad, but it's not quite the same thing. It's also a little bit like the English word soul, but also that's not quite right. Now, in India, and actually quite widespread in cultures around the world, it was quite common to identify yourself with something. Right? It might even be some physical object. Okay? And these days this kind of thinking is very strange, right? But it's actually very common. Like we might think that it's fairly reasonable to identify your own body with yourself, right? That seems pretty straightforward. Or you might identify your brain with yourself, right? Quite a lot of people do that, right? You think that if your body might die, but if you were to cut your head off and keep it in a jar and keep your head alive in a jar, that you'd still be alive. Right? It's on The Simpsons, isn't it? Yeah.
I think some people are freezing their
head. Right, freezing your head so you can revive them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, see, this is a very strange quirk of fate. Now, I used to be in a band and we used to sing a song called A Brain in a Jar. Right? And great song, by the way. And
good.
Couple of you won't find it. You know, very underground. And a couple of years ago, we did this conference in Perth, and one of the people on the conference was this professor at UWA who had taken his own brain cells, his own neurons, and was culturing them in a jar with I know, right? With electrodes in them, embedded in the neurons, right? Growing neurons around electrons into which he would play music and detect how the thing was responding and making music so that the neurons were actually making. This was his idea, that he could train the neurons by making music.
Old Beach Road?
Not yet, no. So before I was singing a song about a brain in a jar, but now we're having a song by a brain in a jar. So that's weird, isn't it? Right? So we think it's natural to identify with your brain, but of course that's entirely acculturated, right? Actually, there's plenty of people around the world that they would never think of identifying themselves as a brain. We only think of ourselves as our brain because we've been told by medicine that that's where our thoughts happen. Right? It's not kind of natural or obvious to identify with your brain. Other people might identify with their spleen. Or people identify with their breath, right? People think that their breath is their soul, like in a very literal sense, right? So for example, there's a story, somebody says, I believe, and this is a real discussion, or, you know, in one of the ancient Indian texts, someone says, yes, your breath is yourself. Now, see, when we hear that, we immediately interpret it in a somewhat kind of more spiritual or metaphysical way, right? But when, in this conversation, your breath is yourself, and the response to that is, well, what about trumpet players? Right? Because when you play the trumpet, well, your breath goes out. So your soul is gone. So why don't you just drop dead? So it shows that they, when they said that the breath is yourself, they really meant your literal physical breath is yourself. And so this is one kind of thing, that this is what people were looking for, some kind of object or some kind of thing which they could identify as their self. Now then other people would say, no, we can't identify with anything physical because physical things are changing, right? Right? Breath changes, how can that be yourself? Even your body changes, how can that be yourself? You get old and so on. Self has to be something which is unchanging, right? So then maybe yourself is some kind of feeling, right? And so people would begin to imagine that their true self is a state of bliss, right? So we're in this delusional state because of suffering. My true self, my real reality, is the state of bliss. And then the Buddha said, well, we can apply that same argument to that. We can say, well, actually, feelings are always impermanent, right? Feelings always change. You can have an idea about an eternal state of bliss, but you never experience an eternal state of bliss, right? All you experience is changing feelings. So how can your feelings be yourself? And so on and so on. So this is how those theories of self come. People develop these ideas of what they can identify with, what can be their self, and they keep making them more and more and more complex, more and more sophisticated, right? But it's never something that you actually find in experience. And in the Buddha's day, before the Buddha came along, some of the most profound philosophers that the world has ever seen came up with a series of texts called the Upanishads. And some of those philosophers like Yajnavalkya and others, some of the greatest sages that the world has ever seen. And they came up with this extraordinary idea that they said that your true self, your ultimate self, has got nothing to do with your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, your body. It's got nothing to do with anything you experience here. It's got nothing to do with the ones that you love, or your life, or your house, or anything that you can see or hear or smell or taste and touch. But your true self, it's the sheer divine consciousness that is the heart of the universe itself. Right? Wow. Right? Now that is an idea. That is a really... I'll come to your question in a sec, yeah. That's a really powerful idea. Yeah? It's a very profound insight, a very profound idea, and a very beautiful idea. Right? That idea that the universe ultimately is a divine essence which has produced life and everything, and you are identical with that divine essence, right? That's a beautiful idea. If I wasn't a Buddhist, that's what I would be. I would believe in that because it's a really lovely idea. Huh? And this was the most powerful, I think the most powerful philosophy of self and identity that's been developed, apart from Buddhism. And it came into the world about 100 or 200 years before the Buddha in these Upanishadic treaties. Yeah? And the Buddha, this is one of the daring things that the Buddha came along and he said, no. Yeah? He said, even that's not enough. Yeah? Yeah? That's not enough. Because even consciousness, yeah? Even if you think of consciousness or universal love, even that is changing. Even that is conditioned. Yeah? And so that we can have that idea of that eternal essence of the cosmos. But when you try to see what that consciousness is, it's always changing.
work out self, or is it changing?
Well, in a sense it is, right? So it's in a sense if you think of yourself as being something that's changing, then that's not self. That's what the Buddha was talking about. You know, yourself is a changing process. So the idea, you could say, it's not no permanent self. Yeah. Sorry, at the back here, you had a question.
But being yourself, hasn't that got a lot to do with your personality?
Yes and no. Yeah, and this is where I said that the English word self is not exactly the same as what we're translating when we talk about self in Buddhism. Yeah. Because your personality, in a sense, your personality is another conditioned thing, right? But the Upanishad, or the non-dual philosophers, would say that that's only a changing manifestation of your true self, which is underneath that personality. Okay, this is what they would say. Yeah, but of course, in the English term, then yes, of course, yourself has a lot to do with your personality. But that's more of a changing expression, because your personality changes as well, doesn't it? Yeah. Might change slowly over time, but it can still change and it's still conditioned. Yeah. So again, not self is not saying that you don't have a personality. It's not saying you don't have an identity. It's not saying that you're not who you are, right? It's just saying that what you are is conditioned and is changing. Yeah? So if we attach to that, then we're going to suffer. Because the thing that we're attaching to, and we do this all the time, don't we? Like, I mean, some of you, I don't know, I'm not speaking personally for myself, but some of you are getting a bit old. Right? Not of this. This is like a random observation, but isn't it weird? Like, when you get older, you don't feel like it, right?
Sure. Yeah.
I feel like a teenager. I feel like, when's this growing up thing going to happen, right? But then I look at what teenagers do, and I think, no, I'm really not a teenager anymore. But I really feel like that. Like specifically, I kind of feel like I identify with that time, maybe around my mid-teens or something like that. I feel like maybe that's like the time when your identity solidifies and you become like who you are and you recognize who you are. I don't know. Maybe that's just me. Maybe I just haven't evolved or developed since that time. I don't know, but the point here is that we attach to ourselves or to a sense of identity, which isn't necessarily who we actually are. This is one of the points that Carl Jung made, a great psychologist. He said that one of the critiques he made of Freudian psychology was that it focused too much on childhood and the events that happened in childhood. And Jung pointed out that human beings keep developing through their whole life, and so it's not just about things that happened to you in your childhood, but it's about how you choose to live your life as an adult. And the answers that we have as young people are not the same answers that we need to reach as when we get older. Yeah? We need to keep on growing and changing as we get older. And so that idea of who we are is growing and changing through our life. Mm.
So, where does ego? Is that an opposite to self?
Where is ego?
Yeah, like, how does that fit in?
How does that fit in? Well, the closest idea to the idea of ego that you have in the Indian philosophies is what's called ahankara, or in Pali, which literally means eye-making. Yeah, eye-making. Right? So the eye making is that kind of force in the mind, right, which actually wants to build up that sense of identity. Yeah? Eye making is actually a better word for it, right, than ego. Yeah? Curious little historical footnote here is that Sigmund Freud never used the word ego in his writings. Right? Nor did he use the word id. Yeah? Interesting, right? Yeah. Whenever we think about Freud, we always think he talked about the ego and these kinds of things. Actually, in his writings, he talked about das Ich, the I. He just used the natural German words for what he was talking about. But when they translated his works into English, the English translator thought that didn't sound kind of formal enough. It didn't sound academic enough or something, so he used the Latin words. And it really makes a difference if, instead of you thinking about the ego, I always was confused about this thing. What's this ego? It sounds like, what's this thing? But it's just talking about the I, right? That sense of the I. So in the Indic philosophies, they talk about ahankara. It's like that force that wants to make up that sense of I. So, and you can feel that in your mind, can't you? With the mind that's like self-justifying. Or, you know, someone criticizes you and you make this argument in your head, or you're, you know, trying to gloss over all your mistakes and your faults and things, and this kind of I which is wanting to bolster your pride and so on. And so that's like an active force. Okay? And interestingly enough, even in the Hindu traditions, where the goal is to realize your true self, okay, then they will recognize that you have to get rid of this ahankara before you can realize your true self. Yeah? Yeah.
Is
the true self the witness of what we are doing, from the point of view of the Hindu tradition? Then yes, right. So the true self is the witness of what we're doing. But what the Buddha pointed out is that witness, that idea of the witness, is what the Buddha called consciousness. Or vijnana. Yeah, and so but that too is conditioned.
Yeah.
Yeah? So from a Buddhist point of view, there's no such thing as a true self. Okay? From a Buddhist point of view, consciousness, the witness, is just another conditioned process. Yeah? But it's the hardest one to see, because it's the seer. Yeah? And in the Upanishads, they always say, the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the unknown knower, that is your true self. And the Buddha said, no, know that unseen seer, that unheard hearer, that unthought thinker, that unknown knower. Know that, and you realize that that's not your true self. That's the difference between those two philosophies. Yeah. But having said which, right, it's a very profound difference. It's not going to make any immediate impact on most people's lives, right? But it's a very subtle point, yeah? These two philosophies have so much in common, and so much of the path, you know, lies walking together. Yeah. Sorry. Yes.
In Christian beliefs,
yeah,
to escape suffering is to embrace it. Is there a parallel in Buddhism?
Sure. Yeah. So in Buddhism, the Buddha talked about the Four Noble Truths. Okay, and the first noble truth is the noble truth of suffering. Yeah, and the Buddha said, with the first noble truth, did he say to escape it? No. Did he say to get rid of it? No. He said parinyaya, to be fully known. Yeah. So the first step on the path to liberation is to fully know suffering, know it all the way through. Yeah. So unless you really know what it is, then you can't find out, you can't escape from it. Yeah.
Same as previous year. As you mentioned, that Upanishad gives us the idea of consciousness, where is consciousness,
right.
And Buddhism refutes that.
Yeah.
Two different. Can we intellectually grasp that idea, or any analogy or any example could we get to understand?
Yeah. Yes, there are. There are various. There are various analogies. One analogy is this image that they have from the Upanishads. It talks about the rivers, right? And so each of the rivers has its own name and its own shape, right? So each river has its own individual identity. Right? Swan River has one identity, and different rivers have their own identity. But when they go into that ocean, yeah, then they lose all their individual identities, and it's just the ocean. Yeah? And so that's an analogy for that idea that our individual self is the same as the cosmos. Yeah? And with the Buddhist idea, the Buddha would say that the oceans, right? From a Buddhist point of view, the oceans are just another part of the conditioned process. Yeah? The oceans seem like they're infinite and eternal, but really they're just conditioned. And the Buddha said, actually, the oceans one day will dry up. Yeah? So that idea that we can disappear, that our individual selves can disappear into that great ocean, is just another part of that cycle. It's another part of the cycle of nature. Yes,
I'm terribly confused. Where does, if you believe in rebirth and reincarnation, so you sort of talking about all the previous lives that you've lived?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Is there a question there?
Well, I'm just stating how confused I am.
Okay, excellent. Excellent. That's good. That's the starting point of knowledge, starting point of true wisdom. Yes, so the Buddha talked about rebirth as being essentially an ongoing flow or a process. Okay, so as I mentioned in the talk, he didn't talk about like an ultimate beginning. He says it's unknowable whether any ultimate beginning is unknowable. But what we can say is we can observe this process now, and we can infer to the past and the future. So what that simply means is that we've had lives before which were pretty much similar to the kind of life that we're having now, and we will have more lives in the future which will be pretty much similar to those. Again, just like you observe in nature, you see that a tree will grow that's similar to the previous tree, and then it will have seeds, and those seeds will sprout, and the next tree will be pretty similar to the one before. It's not identical, it's not the same tree, but it's conditioned by it. And so that kind of process of that kind of changing and flowing of conditions is what the Buddha was talking about when he's talking about rebirth.
When we talk about rebirth, are we talking about the atoms and the elements and the energy moving forward? Because I can, you know, the ego can get its mind head around that. Okay, so I understand I'm energy, I'm atoms, I'm elements. And when I die, it's released and goes back into the ground and then becomes something else, maybe gets drawn up by a tree. I can get my head around that. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, it's more the mental component, right? So yes, that happens, and that's part of who we are, and that participates in that physical process, and that's what that Four Elements meditation actually is about, right?
Yes.
It's about breaking down that and feeling yourself as part of that ongoing process, that physical process.
That came through really strongly for me in that meditation.
Oh, good, yeah. So, but the point of independent origination and teachings on rebirth is what happens to the psychological component, right? What happens to your mind? And so your mind is the same kind of thing, okay? But it is bound by that sense of identity, so that it rather than like a corpse that goes back into the ground, it's rather more like a seed. So it's like a seed which gives rise to a new life, which is relatively similar to the life that was there before. Right. So it's that consciousness. Now, is that consciousness? Can we identify that as a some kind of physical energy? Right? Could you make a consciousness meter and measure it? Right? Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. Well, how does that relate to the realities that are revealed in science? I don't think any of us have really established that. What we can say is that it's a similar kind of thing that we can understand in similar kinds of terms that we talk about in science. Like things like that energy is neither created nor destroyed, but merely transformed. Right? That similar kind of principle. So I'm not saying it's exactly the same thing, but I'm saying it's the same kind of process. And so that evolution, that process of conditionality, and the idea of changing energies, flowing and taking different forms. This is what the Buddha was talking about.
Because I get a little bit confused as well, because like who is the you that had the past lives? That's I mean, I'm going a bit deep here, I know, but
you're on the job.
Who is the you that had no one?
Yeah, like so.
It's not the right way to think about it.
We see our past lives. So who is that that sees their past lives? That's where I lose it.
Don't worry about it too much. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, who is it that sees? It's consciousness that sees. It's not a person who sees.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all.
You're going to get this all the way home.
Sorry? The clock's broken,
don't worry about it.
Alright, okay, no.
Right.
You want the punchline?
We've got this, folks. We've had all the things we're not, we're not this, we're not a pair of shoes.
Okay, right.
Yeah, well, you're getting angry. Who's going home to love me? You know? Who am I?
You ain't no one.
Sorry?
You ain't no one.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, so why worry about it? Exactly. Yeah. That's all right. You want a punchline?
Well, so
the punchline.
Take home with the thing.
And now we can all get some sleep. You don't know what the joke was, do you? No. Okay, so go on. Any other questions?
That's it.
No, that's it.
I was going to ask, is that the answer to everything? Just don't worry about it?
Pretty much, yeah. Pretty much, no worries, mate.
Excellent.
No worries. Yes.
Amen.
Thanks to everyone, all the organisers.
Yep.
All right.